For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford in my respective cave. Timothy O'Donnell's in his respective cave, and Mark Tuttle is in his respective cave, and we're still doing this quarantine kind of thing. Now, one of the advantages that one of the things I've taken advantage of during this quarantine is the fact that you can have books delivered to your Kindle, to your reading device, to your door. And so I've been taking advantage of the time and doing a lot of reading. Now, for me, the subject has primarily been the thing I've missed the most, the Mass. I've picked up several books by Scott Hahn, where he talks about the Jewish roots of the Mass, talks about the Word in the Mass, the Supper of the Lamb, all kinds of different approaches, three or four books of his that I've gone through already. And all I can say is, you know, it's like reading the menu, but then not being able to order. So I have, you know, I have this newborn appreciation for the Mass, and it's going to be another week or two before we can actually attend Mass. And so, you know, while we're in the cave, I've been doing my reading. I'm sure you guys have been picking up books in the evening, you know, just trying to pass the time and get it by. But I would say this, since we got probably another couple weeks for some people and maybe longer than that for others, what would be the official or semi-official caveman reading list for quarantine?
Ooh, an official caveman reading list.
Yeah. As opposed to the unofficial one, which is where we burn the books.
Right. Yeah. So this is the one that we like carve onto the walls in great big granite letters so that the people can see what these books are. So yeah, and I guess it would depend on, you know, how long we have in quarantine, because, you know, War and Peace would definitely be up there, but I'm hoping we don't have that much time.
Yeah, I would not recommend starting the Summa Theologica right now.
Right, exactly. You know, and you mentioned that, you know, you start asking the question, well, what do you do with yourself when you are kind of stuck at home and you really can't get out? And, you know, St. Thomas found himself in that situation. He was locked up by his brothers in a castle. And what he did is he memorized the entire Bible while he was there. So, I mean, I guess that's always an option. If people want to spend their time, they can memorize, you know, the entire Bible from beginning to end. That might be a good caveman thing to do.
That would be impressive.
Well, I don't think we use our memories quite the way people did in antiquity anyway, where you just didn't have access to not only pen and paper, so to speak, but you certainly didn't have anything that was electronic to store, access information or pull information. I mean, we have the opposite problem now, right? We have, like, there's so much information out there at our fingertips. It's hard to filter. But yeah, Mark, why don't we lay out some reading material, if you will, digitally here over the airwaves, and make some recommendations around, or at least share with people kind of what's got our interest right now, and what are some things, maybe new reads that we have going on, or perhaps we're rereading many books are worth reading multiple times over one's lifetime. So I'll put the question to you. And Kent, you got to play along here too. So I know you mentioned Scott Hahn, but Mark, where would you start with your reading, your caveman reading list?
Well, you know, I just got done kind of teaching a little bit of a class about this. And as I was teaching the book, I got into it a little bit more. I've read it before multiple times, but it fits so well with quarantine that I just kept reading it and rereading it. And it is one of the all-time great classics, and it happens to fit very, very well the circumstances of the whole quarantine of, you know, of kind of being there confined, left to your own devices. And not only that, but feeling a little bit sorry for yourself at the same time, and a little bit scared and a little bit anxious about what's going to happen. And that is Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy. So, that's like an
extreme. No, I know, but you don't hear too many kids named Boethius anymore.
No. Believe it or not, this was for a long time the second most read book beyond the Bible. So, through the Middle Ages, and it influenced Dante, it influenced Chaucer, it influenced Milton, it influenced a whole bunch of people down the road. So it is a bedrock of the Western intellectual tradition. And as you said, most people have not even heard of it, much less read it. So Boethius was an advisor to the Germanic king, the Visigothic king that took out the very last Roman emperor. So the last Roman emperor was Romulus Augustulus, believe it or not. So, you know, Rome started with the Romulus, ended with the Romulus. Boethius was the advisor to this Visigothic king, and the Visigothic king got a little paranoid and blamed Boethius for a conspiracy by the senators, the Roman senators that were still there, to try to take him out. And so he was locked up, he was separated from his family, and he was eventually executed. But while he was under arrest, he wrote this book about this vision of Lady Philosophy coming to kind of shake him back up and kind of lead him out of his self-pity, because obviously, as you can imagine, being arrested by the king and kind of knowing that your days may be numbered, he was kind of feeling sorry for himself. Not only that, but he had kind of done the right thing. He had been honest and virtuous, and it was kind of a bunch of evil people that sort of conspired to have him executed. So here he is, having done the right thing, having lived his life for virtue, having lived his life for philosophy. And what did it get him? It got him, well, eventually an appointment with the executioner's axe. And so,
boy, we see that repeated over and over and over again.
So, you know, and luckily in the midst of the quarantine, we're not quite facing execution, but we are facing a lot of uncertainty. We are facing a lot of questions about what the future is going to hold for us, for our families. And Boethius is a fantastic meditation and a fantastic reminder that our ultimate happiness is not here on earth. Our ultimate happiness is not even controlled by the things of earth, that we need to look beyond our circumstances and realize the blessings that we have. And most of those flow not from this world, but from the next world. And so Boethius is a great reminder to cast our vision farther than our own circumstances. And it's a great way and method in a lot of ways of finding a happy existence, even in the midst of the most awful, horrible circumstances you can imagine. So Boethius, as far as a quarantine read, as I said, I was teaching a class and we were going over it, and I went, how appropriate for our circumstances. So I just kept reading. And it's a great book to sink your teeth into in the middle of a quarantine like this.
I got to tell you, it reminds me a lot of, probably been 15 years since I picked up Boethius. So you're right. That's a good recommendation for me too, because I need to pick it up again. And it reminds me though, of that, maybe Socrates might be the first person I encountered, with what Boethius lived out, and Socrates did too, which is that, you know, he had a maxim that really Socrates did, that said, you know what, people really can't harm you. It's not that, and by that, it doesn't mean that you won't suffer, that other people can't injure you or do violence to you, harm you physically, cause great suffering in you. But what he meant by that other people can harm, you can only harm yourself, meaning that the real you, the true you, is we would as Catholics say, our we might point to say our soul, that we was talking about is that there's this, our innermost being, which has our, the voice of our conscience, and where our core values reside. Only oneself can, only we can only violate those core values by consent. And that's when we really are truly harmed. And I think of that, so Socrates had that, Boethius lived that, right? He had a tremendous suffering, but he stayed true to who he was in the deepest sense of that. And I think about like the, when I think of like the three conditions that we taught that have to be met to commit a mortal sin, of course, one of them is you have to give your full consent, right? You can't sin on accident. And so that kind of points to me the same thing of Boethius's life, the lives of many great saints, martyrs, right? Are what martyrs we see are staying true to they're staying true to their deepest core values, the truths about who they are, and the purpose of their life, the ultimate purpose, which is beatitude.
Yeah, Boethius's understanding of beatitude too, that you only achieve beatitude through virtue. And that there's nobody and no circumstances that are going to be able to keep you from acting virtuously. So, you know, you can have the entire world acting viciously, but that is not in any way going to impede you from acting virtuously. And not only that, but happiness exists in acting virtuously. So, you know, even amidst the worst types of things, if you keep yourself focused on remaining virtuous, being virtuous, continuing to act virtuously, you'll find happiness. You'll find joy, even in the midst of, you know, really adverse circumstances and suffering. So I think that's a great reminder too, is that it's virtuous living and avoiding vice and keeping that focus, you know, even when we're tempted and even when everything seems to be falling apart, realizing that ultimately that's not where happiness is. Happiness doesn't lie in pursuing our jobs. It doesn't lie in our families even. It lies within finding that happiness through virtuous living within our own, you know, kind of inner self, as you were saying. Not that those other things don't matter, but quite honestly, they only matter in as much as they lead to that happiness of virtue that resides within each of us.
All right. And with that, we need to take a break. We're going to come back with more of a look at the stuff we should be reading while we're quarantined and maybe even after we get released from quarantine. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor, tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest? Or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Caves. I'm Kent Blanford in the cave with me, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, Mr. Mark Tuttle, and we are doing the book list this time around, the type of thing that we would highly suggest you be reading during our quarantine and even after the quarantine ends. We've been talking about Boethius previously, and next we're going to, I'm going to toss it to Tim. Tim, what would you recommend? What's the book that you would pick up to read while you have the time?
I'm going to advance the timeline from Boethius a little bit and actually pick up a thread that Mark laid down and kind of continue it. I've got to throw out there The Divine Comedy by Dante Alighieri.
Ooh.
As a must read during quarantine. As Mark, I mean, it's simply a masterpiece. And there's something in it for everyone. And the divine, so comedy isn't meant the way it's written in Italian, actually, and then an older form of Italian, not contemporary Italian, very Latinized. And you can get great translations of it. I'll recommend Anthony Esselens, who's a great Catholic contemporary. He writes a lot of really great articles and stuff. He has one really great, he has a great translation. But the Divine Comedy is really about it's really a walk through heaven, hell, and purgatory, not in that order. And what picking up from what Mark was talking about, a life of virtue, it makes plain through this just absolutely beautiful prose, and it's actually written in poetic form. You actually encounter a variety of different what we would call historical figures, and we begin to see in a very vivid and compelling way God's providential plan for virtue, vice, and the rewards and punishments that accompany how we spend our time here on earth. It's an extremely compelling way. There's also, I would also recommend a nice book or tabletop, you know, kind of coffee book, table size illustration that actually you can find it from time to time, you know, through one of your online sellers, like an Amazon or Barnes and Noble, I think was actually the one to put it out, with illustrations. And the illustrations can be extremely helpful, especially if you want to go through it with maybe a younger audience to kind of bring the story to life. But it is just absolutely magnificent. And just saying the three Latin words for it, you know, Inferno, Purgatio, Paradiso, I know you've read it, Mark. What would you say about the Divine Comedy?
Well, you know, Dante found himself in a similar situation as Boethius did when he started this. He'd been exiled from his home city, Florence, and in trying to, I think, reconcile this ultimate wrong that had been done to him. And, you know, unfortunately, he found himself exiled somewhat because of the machinations of the Pope at the time. So the Pope had kind of double-crossed him a little bit. He had been the ambassador to go to Rome to try to negotiate a peace treaty. And while he was there, the Pope had invited in a foreign force into Florence that wound up resulting in his exile from Florence. So he had some, you know, he had some issues he had to sort through, and found himself exiled. So once again, you know, he's writing this from a place where, you know, a lot of us are finding ourselves, we're suddenly confined. We're not able to do what we would like to do. And you know, some of us are kind of looking at the situation around going, you know, this is all out of my control. How do I deal with it? And so, you know, Dante's journey through hell and then purgatory and then through the Paradiso is not just a spiritual journey, but I think there's a bit of an emotional journey there for him too, that, it's fun. You know, there are so many levels to the Inferno, not just the loggias and the, you know, of the different cantos going down and up, but, you know, there's a certain historical sense about it. You know, you can go and research the different personages and get an awesome history of Florence, of Rome, of the papacy at the time, of the Holy Roman Empire at the time. So you can get a great history lesson just by following along with Dante's characters that he's got through there. You know, on the other hand, there's a spiritual dimension to it that you know, I read the Purgatory as Lenten reading one year of a way to walk through the seven, you know, the seven deadly sins, and you know, kind of think about the opposite virtues, and you know, it's a great spiritual meditation for your own spiritual benefit. And then there's a philosophical element to it too. Dante was he incorporated a lot of St. Thomas's theology into it, especially when you get to the Paradiso. You wind up with St. Bonaventure there. You wind up with St. Thomas Aquinas there. You wind up with the apostles there. You wind up with a lot of philosophical concepts thrown into this creation of heaven, you know, kind of making heaven go round, so to speak. So there's multiple levels to it. It's you really could spend a lifetime with the Divine Comedy.
Yeah, it's simply, like I said, magnificent. I also would point out, and you were suggestive of this in your comments, Mark, it's a great teacher. The story is a great teacher. They're especially of moral philosophy, moral theology, from a Catholic perspective. And one of the, I guess the first time I read it, one of the things that really caught my attention in the Inferno was, you know, I kind of thought hell was a one size fits all. Yeah, like there's kind of a door you get pushed through or whatever, you fall down it, you know, you're up there in front of St. Peter. It doesn't go well because he's listing all your faults and you've not reconciled yourself, you've not converted, blah blah blah. And then all of a sudden, you know, the trap door opens up. You're standing, you know, it's express lane straight down into the Inferno is how I kind of imagined it. And then basically, you get barbecued eternally is kind of how I saw it. Barbecue with no sauce, so you just kind of roasted. That's not what's going on in the Inferno at all. It will disabuse you of any, if anyone listening has any of those sorts of notions. And what it does is, it lays out God's wisdom, because the punishments fit the crime. And it's a great reminder of that God is wisdom itself and God is justice. And so after sort of the jolt and the sweaty brow I had thinking of my own sins and how calculating how quickly I could get to confession having entered into the Inferno, there's a kind of lasting consolation that comes with it, in that it seems so often in this life that the truly evil, wicked people don't ever seem to get their full comeuppance for the terrible things that they've done. And so it's helpful to know, it's again consoling, that yeah, someone in this life may not get all the punishment they deserve, but God is going to complete and deliver complete justice at the end. And I think that hell is real. That's another really important lesson from reading the Divine Comedy. It's a very real place, and a really awful thing, and something to be avoided. When there has been some sappy talk, I would call it, in some circles that I've been reading and listening to, that you know, everyone's going to go to heaven. I don't think so. I don't think everyone's going to go. God seems to have real enemies in this world, in that they're not going to go because they don't want to.
Yeah, the Inferno is the most vivid of, I would say, the three parts of the Divine Comedy, but the other two are definitely well worth the read as well. And you know, I went to a Theology of the Body talk. Theology of the Body is all the rage. And you get to the top of Mount Purgatory, you read through the top of Mount Purgatory, and you realize that it is it is the idea of embodied love that launches him up into heaven. And it's the same sort of concept that's there in John Paul II's Theology of the Body. So you see this in poetic form built beautifully into his understanding of sort of how we perfect ourselves, how our souls are perfected through the process of really kind of wrestling with what our sins are and then correcting our faults, finding God's forgiveness, until we hit a point where we're so filled with love that it just lifts us up into the stratosphere. And it's a beautiful scene where he's launched from the Mount Purgatory into the Paradiso, and you move from the Purgatorio into his conception of what heaven's like. You know, those parts, I think, are equally spiritually moving, and also an equal reminder of just how beautiful, but how arduous the spiritual journey can be.
You know, that that's also a great point that you're alluding to there on, again, another teachable moment from Divine Comedy throughout is, especially in Purgatio, is this faith and works, right? Many of our Protestant brothers and sisters take issue with faith and works as faith alone, as a solo fide. And I would say that it illustrates, as you were just mentioning, it illustrates that we're to put in, there's some effort that's required. There's effort required on our part. There's effort and there's cooperation with the graces that God is giving us. And you see that in Purgatio, that effort and perseverance matter. They can make all the difference. And you know what else is important, Mark? We're up against a break, so we better pause here, and then when we come back, we are going to continue with our Caveman official reading list right after this.
And you're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
At Catholic Radio, we love to hear from you. Call us anytime. Just recently, we found this message on our voicemail.
I'm a non-Catholic that listens to your Catholic radio station, and I just wanted to thank you guys. I listen to Catholic Answers and Al Cresta sometimes, and I think her name's Teresa Tommy. I listen to her and another show or two. I appreciate it.
Call us at 317-870-8400 and let us know what you're thinking.
I just called to say, even though I'm not a Catholic, I listen to your station.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Kent Blanford, and Tim O'Donnell has in his hand right now the chisel and the hammer as he is putting into the walls of the cave the reading list, our quarantine reading list. And we've gone through a couple of spiritual classics. They're related to each other. We kind of took the world's first, in some ways, self-help book, Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy. We talked a little bit about that. And then we talked about what I would say is probably one of the central masterpieces of Christendom and of Catholicism, and that's the Divine Comedy, Dante's Divine Comedy. And for this next recommendation, you know, I think we're going to go a little bit in the opposite direction, and I'm going to recommend Hunkering Down with Friedrich Nietzsche.
Boo! Boo! Boo!
Now, I'll tell you what.
He's a villain. He's a villain, Mark.
So Tim is bristling at this idea, but I had a friend who he was a Cistercian monk, and when he would bring the novices in, he would start their spiritual direction by having them hunker down with Nietzsche and read Nietzsche, and particularly read the books of Nietzsche that are kind of the criticisms of Christianity. So Ecce Homo is one of them, and the genealogy of the genealogy of the generation of morals. That's another one. You know, those two books and a few other ones. Now, Nietzsche's a little bit hard to pin down because he didn't write large, giant books the way Dante did. He wrote short little books, and those books are usually put together in very enigmatic aphorisms. So he's a little bit of a kind of a puzzle within a puzzle to try to read and work through. But Nietzsche lays out in a lot of ways, I think, what we don't want Christianity to become. His critique of Christianity, I won't call it a caricature, but he has a very keen eye, and I think a very good sense of what the dark side of, I guess, Christians who go astray can quickly become. And so when you look at him that way, and you look at him as like kind of, if you know, some of the younger members of our audience may not understand this, but it used to be that when you took a picture with a photograph, it would put a negative image onto a film. And if you ever took the film out of the camera, you could see that all the white parts of what should be white are black, and all the black parts of what should be white are white. And so it was like the same image, but in complete reversal of what you'd expect. And it always looked really interesting to see these pictures that you took in their complete opposite. And Nietzsche has a way of presenting Christianity that's in the negative of what Christianity is and what Christianity should be in a way that a lot of things pop out at you. And it becomes very illuminating as to what our spiritual vocation ought to be and what our calling ought to be and what it can quickly fall into and become what it shouldn't be.
Yeah, he is. Friedrich Nietzsche is a very compelling writer, a very gifted writer. Sometimes German writers don't translate all that well into English, but I would say he does. Like von Balthasar, he's tough in English. Plus, he would write on and on and on. That one sentence would go on for like three full pages. So there's some of that sometimes when you count these German thinkers. But I would say, and Nietzsche is extremely important philosophically because he's had such an influence on the way we think. I would say in political philosophy especially he shows up. But I would say he gives us, for example, the Übermensch, the Superman, and unlike the beloved cartoon comic book character, he develops a kind of morality, and I found it really his book Beyond Good and Evil, which the title kind of is very telling. But there's said we ought to push past the constraints of traditional morality, especially as it's offered up through a Christian lens. And by that, I think he means both probably primarily a Lutheran, but plenty of that in common with Catholic and other kind of main Christian denominations. But Beyond Good and Evil, the Supermensch. The person or man, if you will, who is strong enough to take what he will. Because at the end of the day, for Nietzsche, at least in that book, it's the will to power, that what's really going on, what's really motivating our actions at rock bottom of our goals, our aspirations, our relationships, is a will to power, that we desire power. And we shouldn't temper that as I read Nietzsche, but rather we need to embrace that about ourselves. And then, of course, it gets and some will say fairly or unfairly, but when you read Beyond Good and Evil, it's not a surprise, I don't think, from our perch here, looking back on National Socialism, that's Hitler himself and other top National Socialists found Nietzsche to furnish them with some ideas that they put into action.
You know, there's a side of Nietzsche that's also very prophetic, because he wrote at a time when the experiment in modernism, so this idea of trying to base morality, trying to base I think all of life scientifically to a certain extent, and get back to what we can only know with certainty, it was unraveling and starting to fall apart. And I think Nietzsche saw very clearly that without reason, without a common understanding of truth, which had kind of emerged, by the time he was writing, the only thing you're left with is bald assertion, just your own will. To dominate other people, that was what was going to win the day intellectually. And he saw that very clearly. And so, a lot of what he was writing was kind of urging people to try to embrace an ethos that I think we see all too commonly all around us. And I think people that read Nietzsche will recognize the contemporary world very much in what he's explaining, that there's no longer any intellectual debate. He kind of says intellectual debate's over. It's all a matter of who can shout the loudest, who can have the most force, who can use his power and his will to shut the other person up. And so I think a lot of people kind of see that, and they're going to recognize a lot of elements of our modern world. One of the one of the other philosophers that we've talked about in the cave before, Alistair MacIntyre, you know, he breaks it down and basically says, you know, in the wake of this sort of falling apart of modernism and the Enlightenment, we're left with two alternatives. We can either go back and try to resurrect some of Aristotle's ideas and build a Aristotelian, and as Catholics, I would take that one step further and say a Thomistic kind of understanding of the world based on natural law, based on common understandings of common projects, rebuilding community, and going through the efforts to kind of get beyond the ultimate quest of a truth with a capital T, but to find maybe smaller scale truths which we can organize our lives around. We can either do that, or the alternative to Aristotle and St. Thomas is Nietzsche. And that's the world that we live in. And I think MacIntyre is exactly right. You know, I think Nietzsche gives us a very good view of what's at stake. If we as Catholics can't embrace Christianity, and if we can't embrace, I think, a Catholic philosophical worldview and start to rebuild the world from where it's kind of fallen to, we're going to be stuck in a world that's described by Nietzsche. And, you know, it's very unsettling to read Nietzsche because he's hard to argue with. You know, he lays out these very bombastic aphorisms. But when you start to try to argue back, it becomes increasingly difficult because he's describing in a lot of ways a world that we live in already.
That's a good way to put it. You know, Nietzsche, you know, trained as a, you know, basically a kind of almost translator, right? He was working with different versions of the same ancient text. So going back to prior to the printing press, everything was copied, right, by hand. And so that would allow for great works that were circulating. You know, were being copied, but then they, you know, copies were never, may or may not be 100% accurate. And then so he began to see he drew the conclusion. I think this really sets up a lot of his philosophy, which is that then everything it undermines his ability to have confidence in objective truth. And he sees everything really as more as a perspective. Like you have your, and this is all around us today. You have your perspective. I have mine. In fact, that's a critical part or essential part of polite conversation and dialogue with other people is to say, okay, well, here's my perspective. You know, here's how, you know, and then you say yours. And then if your quote unquote perspective, Mark, even if it's contradictory to mine, we rarely would take up the project of trying to reconcile two contradictory statements that we've just made. We just simply let it go. And it may be that the topic's inconsequential, but a lot of times it is consequential. And but we don't if we don't think there's any objective truth to move towards, we have no commitment then to do the hard work of engaging each other. So what I would say is, boy, Nietzsche's all around us. Read Nietzsche.
Yep. You know, I think, you know, he ties in with our previous recommendations as well, because Boethius and then, you know, Dante followed on basically saying that greatness comes from seeking God and leaving the cares of the world behind and recognizing that the cares of this world will never lead to happiness. And for Nietzsche, this was very, very disappointing. Nietzsche wanted, above all, to find greatness in this world. He wanted to be a great person, and he wanted to be one of those great names that went down in history. And so he urged people to try to grasp onto this life with everything they could, to try to suck the marrow out of it, to try to find greatness. And eventually, Nietzsche went insane. You know, he died in a fit of madness. There's lots of speculation as to what caused this madness, but he went insane and he died a very lonely man, having lost his wits, having in a lot of ways lost his humanity. And so he stands in stark contrast to Boethius and Dante, that are reminding us that our true selves, who we are truly as human beings, can only be found in God. And Nietzsche reminds us that when we steer away from that path, we quickly descend down the path towards madness.
And we have to take a break right now. We'll be back with more of our official book list for cave reading. Right after this, you're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Alexa, what's the weather forecast for today?
Alexa, what time is the Colts game today?
Alexa, remind me to pick up the dry cleaning tomorrow.
Has Alexa become a part of your daily routine? Then make sure that routine includes Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Quick, easy access to Catholic programming 24/7. Just say, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Kent Blanford and Timothy O'Donnell, and we are talking about the quarantine all-time reading list, at least according to cavemen. What should we be spending our time reading? What's worth reading? And we've had some doozies so far, Tim. We started off with Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, which a lot of people haven't heard of, but honestly, it was one of the most widely read books through the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance. It was a huge influence on just about everything that came after that. We read one of the people who was influenced by it, Dante. We talked about the Divine Comedy, all the different levels of what you can pull out of the Divine Comedy. And then we talked about the lessons that we can take from Friedrich Nietzsche. And, what you can get of, as you put it, one of philosophy's great villains, why he's still worth reading and why he's still worth contemplating what he has to say. So now we're ready for our fourth and final recommendation here. And what do you have in the hopper for us, Tim?
Okay, you've heard Burger King has the Impossible Whopper. Okay, I'm gonna throw out this is for the long view, just in case we're all hoping and praying quarantine's ending soon. If not, then this recommendation is for the long haul, the long game, okay? And it is and maybe bending the rules slightly. And I'm going to recommend our listeners pick up The Great Books of Western Civilization, all 60 volumes.
That would be for the long, long haul of
correct. Yeah, that's 4 years or more at least. But I'm going to give us some shortcuts. After I'll kind of explain what it is a little bit. Let's talk about it a little bit, and then there's a couple of shortcuts that one can get at some of the really fun material that emerged. So, Great Books of Western Civilization. Mortimer, what a great, great author, wanted to become Catholic really at the very end of his life. Dr. Mortimer Adler, University of Chicago, really kind of forgotten these days, but just a giant of the 20th century in education, especially starting right in the early 1940s and moving up until into the 70s. And then education with the Cultural Revolution here in the U.S., he gets kind of pushed aside, but he's just got a great, great book. He's wrote many books, but his biggest contribution to what we're talking about today, and really, it's such a wonderful, wonderful gift to all of us, is The Great Books of Western Civilization was his, he led a project team at the University of Chicago to pull together for us. They did this very heavy lifting for us to look back over the heritage of the writings of great great books across genres. So this over the last 2,400 years, and then put all those books together into what initially was 54 volumes, and now is 60 volumes. So if you're old enough, or if you're listening, your parents may have a set of old Encyclopedia Britannica, for example. They look kind of like that. But what they but it's comprised of philosophy and religion, imaginative literature, science, and then history. And it it allows one, by reading through these volumes, a couple of things. One is it aims at giving the person an authentically liberal education by reading the great books by people that we've been talking about already on the show. And so it achieves that. In fact, at least one college, and I think it's Wyoming Catholic, uses the great books as, like, that's your four-year program. You're going to be in an instructor-led effort to get through most or all of these great works. But there's the jewel, I would say, that emerges out of the great books is that the team felt, Adler's team and other, felt that they had found 102 great ideas that everyone was, this great arc of humanity had been really in one way or another talking about, these great ideas, ideas like justice, ideas like what's an angel, angels, ideas like permanence and change. And you can pick up a book called Great Ideas, and in there are short introductory essays to each of these 102. You actually may wind up with 103 when you revise, of these great ideas, and then they're cross-referenced across these 60 volumes. So maybe that's cheating a little, because it's supposed to be a book recommendation, but it is. I bring it up in when I teach. I bring up for college students. I always try to sneak in, a conversation like this, because at the end of the day, everyone can become a well-educated person. In other words, it's sure colleges and universities, with the aid of staff and administration, instructors, professors, blah blah blah, can certainly aid you in your journey, especially if you need to acquire specialized knowledge. But if for someone to be a well-rounded, well-educated person, that series, that Great Books of Western Civilization, accomplishes that. And you can buy that series, those volumes, through Amazon, et cetera. And they range at different times, but, $600, $800. And then you can online get a reading plan for free, and there's online discussion groups, et cetera. So there's no reason. So I tell my students, look, for under $1,000, you can, with the effort, you put the effort in, but for $1,000, you can give yourself you can become an educated person without an institution.
So I'll bite on that a little bit and ask you, Tim, there's a lot of subjects that you could spend that amount of time, that amount of effort reading and kind of imbibing. I mean, you could get an excellent engineering education, for instance, kind of doing similar of going through and reading in depth 50 to 60 of the great works on engineering. Giving yourself a great education about physics, building upon that, etc. Why a read through classic literature, classic philosophy, classic history to become an educated person, as you put it?
Yeah, I would say, I'm not sure if you want, I'm not sure you could become a qualified mechanical engineer by simply picking, no one's put together the way Adler did for us on a liberal education where they did the hard lifting and assembled these things for good reasons. There isn't sort of an off-the-shelf package to say, okay, I want to be an anesthesiologist. Which books do I have to read? So it's not like that. It's not quite going to be the same. Because again, that specialized knowledge that I think is going to require a different kind of setting. But setting that aside for a minute, I would say to your broader question is this: what a liberal education does, what it achieves in a way that so much of our education is specialized fails to do so often is it lets you see the interconnectedness and purposes of things that reading down a very narrow, specific path doesn't allow you to see. An example might be you could go to a great engineering school and become a mechanical engineer and design really great bridges. But what you often won't be taught, though, which you're not going to find is, why do we have bridges? You know, like, what's the purpose? You know, what are communities? What's the purpose of connecting point A to point B? That's going to be found in a very liberal education. And if you think about a friend of the show, we got to have him back on, is Dr. David Deeville. You know, would talk about this quite a bit and quite more eloquently than I can. But there's even, and I read in one of his articles last year, I think it was, there's even really good data that's emerging that shows if you get a really good liberal education, your paycheck coming out of college is at the middle to lower end. It's not the highest paying job right out of school. Your engineers, et cetera, are going to make more money right out of the starting box. But fast forward 20 years, and people with liberal educations begin to earn more money over the long haul because they can see things in relations to things because they've read widely by what are arguably some of the greatest minds of all time. And so they're better prepared to take on the better challenges and new settings as they present themselves because of how it forms one's intellect. So the advantage is it's a kind of a tortoise and a hare. It's more of a tortoise, but remember, the tortoise wins the race at the end.
That's the lesson in that story everybody always forgets. The tortoise wins. People always forget that. Slow and steady will win the race. That's the whole moral of that story. You know, the thing with this quarantine, for as many bad things that are going on in our world right now, there's a lot of good things and a lot of good opportunities that are out there. You mentioned this core of books that Adler put together. A lot of the plays and a lot of the dramas that are in there are being offered for free on video. They're Shakespeare plays are out there right now. They're not in Adler's collection, but there's a lot of classical operas that are being offered out there on YouTube. So there's an opportunity right now as people are generously giving for all of us to entertain ourselves at home, for us to, as you said, broaden our minds and our experiences a little bit and dive in and become educated in a lot of these things that we may have missed out on as we were going through school and focusing on our careers and focusing on what we thought we needed to know. Now we've got an opportunity to go back, look at a lot of these classical works, look at some Shakespeare, some operas, some of these classical works that Adler put together, and really help us get a well-rounded classical liberal arts education.
And with that, that's about all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for this week. We've got our list put together. We've got the official Caveman's Quarantine Reading List. Boethius, Dante, Nietzsche, Adler, and more. Lots to consider, lots to read. But while you're doing it, stay safe and keep us in mind. Keep us in your prayers. We'll keep you in ours. For Mark Tuttle, for Timothy O'Donnell, I'm Kent Blanford. Thanks for listening to The Catholic Cave this week. We'll catch you next time.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.